Well, hello and welcome to another session of the War Pod. Now, we're doing something a little bit different today. The Remote Warfare Programme is obviously based at the Oxford Research Group, an independent peace and security organisation, and there are three programmes at the organisation: the Remote Warfare Programme, the Sustainable Security Programme, and the Strategic Peace Building Programme. And I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by a member of the Strategic Peace Building Programme today. And who are you? What's your name?
Hello, everyone. It's Marwa Babbat, and I am currently leading ORG's Strategic Peace Building Programme, and mainly focusing on our work in Yemen.
Absolutely. And I should have said, I don't think I did. My name's Liam Walpole, and I'm the Policy Officer at the Remote Warfare Programme. And the focus today is, of course, as Marwa's already alluded to, is about the conflict in Yemen. And that's the focus of the Strategic Peace Building, well, one of the focuses, one of the projects of the Strategic Peace Building Programme. It's a project funded by the FCO, that's correct, isn't it?
Yes, by
the Conflict Stability and Security Fund, this cross-government fund that funds lots of different work for the FCO, Ministry of Defence and DFID. And this one is led by the FCO. I've got that right. Good.
Right. Yeah.
But we wanted to talk about it in the context of some recent, well, big news stories around the focus around Saudi Arabia, and then go on to talk about the challenges of kind of the UK, at least in the UK, us always focusing on the role of Saudi Arabia. So it'd be interesting to sort of get your take on what's happened over the last couple of weeks with the Court of Appeal ruling that Saudi arms sales are unlawful. And the UK has had to suspend future export licences, and we now know that the government's going to appeal. So I just wondered, there has been quite a lot of focus over the last couple of years about arms sales being provided or sold by the UK to Saudi Arabia that might then go and be used in Yemen, and the implications of the Saudis not using them in accordance with IHL. And I just wondered, what was your take on what does this mean? The outcome of this case?
Well, I guess from a UK perspective, especially for UK activists and those who are concerned about UK adherence to IHL when it comes to arms sales, I think it's a great victory.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good thing that we are trying to monitor the role of arm producers like the UK and how the arms are used in Saudi and other places. However, how much is this relevant to Yemen is a different question.
Yeah.
So what does it mean for Yemen?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean really anything.
Okay.
Because, yes, good thing that Saudis are not going to get more arms to bombard Yemenis, but are Saudis the only problem Yemen has?
Well, we'll see what happens to the court case. They might be fine. The government might get away
with
it. But yeah.
Yeah. So I think we need to ask ourselves questions beyond the case of stopping armament to Saudis and how that relates to other contexts that that has been used for campaigning for the case.
So that's a really interesting point. I mean, something that the Saudi Foreign Minister Adel Al Jubeir, I've probably pronounced that terribly, but one of the things he was sort of saying is that, you know, this doesn't necessarily say or reflect badly on the Saudis. It's not about any wrongdoing that's been done by them. That's what they're arguing, and that it's for the UK to decide. And I suppose the argument that he made as well is that stopping weapons to Saudi Arabia or the coalition in Yemen, it basically, his words, is playing into the hands of the deaf to the America crowd, which is clearly the Saudis trying to, you know, deal with the politics of everything that's going on. And one of the things that we have tried to argue at the Remote Warfare Programme is that arms sales are a small part of the security relationship between the UK and Saudi Arabia, and of course many other Western countries as well. The US provides much more arms than we do to Saudi Arabia. And that we can't just focus on that as one thing, because it's a much bigger issue, and why we're in Yemen, etc., etc. And I suppose we have had a conversation in the past when I've written about, you know, if the UK wants to be global Britain, what if that means? As far as I understand it, one of the principles or one of the elements of global Britain is that the UK can act as a champion of the rules-based international order. Some of our listeners might say, well, what does that mean? What is the international rules-based order? But that if you want to do that, you have to be seen to be not white as, you know, whiter than white, but you have to have some credibility about your approach. And I know that when we had a conversation when that article came out back in September, I think it was 2018, one of the things that you were saying is that the problem is, kind of going back to the points that you made from the start, that you focus far too much on Saudi Arabia, who is, of course, leading this coalition, but there's the UAE and other countries as well. Do you think that that is that improving the way the UK journalists, politicians sort of look at this conflict? Do you feel like they get that nuance? Because clearly you've given evidence to committees in Parliament before, and do you feel like you've had to kind of stress the point that, you know, it's not all about Saudi Arabia, it's much more complex than arms sales, Saudi Arabia, security relationship, and it's also about Yemen.
Well, I think sadly, I have to say, that hasn't really improved that much.
Okay.
And big part of the problem is the focus on Saudi. And
yep.
Like, we remember the Khashoggi incident, mm-hmm. and then suddenly I was reading a report about the Washington Post's the word Yemen appeared 300 more times in the Washington Post since the Khashoggi killing.
That's very interesting.
Or murder. So how kind of international journalism in the UK and elsewhere are focusing on Yemen from a Saudi-led coalition lens is problematic, because then we're overlooking the local context, the local actors, who's actually playing. But also, we always say the Saudi-led coalition, and we remember Saudi and forget about the coalition. Then the conversation becomes Saudi aggression on Yemen what the Saudis are doing wrongly or rightly in Yemen, depending on your position.
Sure.
So I think it is important to look at this. It is important to look at what the Saudis are doing, what kind of IHL violations are being committed. However, is this kind of everything that is happening in Yemen? Who else is committing IHL crimes in Yemen? Why did the Saudi coalition started bombarding Yemen in the first place? Why did that happen? And then who should be involved, and what we should be talking about is the important part of journalism. I think cherry-picking fact is problematic.
That's true. I mean, and I think from our perspective, what hasn't been clear is, and there's been growing frustration with the government over this over the last couple of months, when back in, I think it was March, there was credible allegations in British newspapers that Special Forces, or Special Boat Service, specifically was being deployed, or had been deployed in Yemen, and was engaging in gun battles in a combat role against Houthi rebels, when clearly the UK government in the past has said it is not a party to the conflict. And before we get on to sort of look at your role as an analyst of that conflict and the work that you're doing around the Strategic Peacebuilding Programme, I just wondered, you know, do you think it's an issue when it comes to the UK's position at the UN as a penholder on Yemen, and it's, at least ostensibly, its leading role as an actor, a key actor in sort of the reaching a political settlement in Yemen, that those revelations undermine its role as a neutral broker? Or do you think that actually, to those actors on the ground, the key actors involved, do they just not see those issues, and are we overblowing them?
I think issues are seen by local actors, and here it's important to mention that it is seen by the internationally recognized government of Yemen and the Houthi rebels. And here we're not saying that the the UK's government support to Saudi is not necessarily immediately transactional to the support mm-hmm. of Yemeni government, although that is the official statement of the government.
The British government.
You would hear differently from how the Yemeni government mm-hmm. feel about it.
Sure.
So there is it is uh-huh. a debatable issue. While the Houthi stance is always that America and the UK are the bad mm-hmm. guys who are mm-hmm. supplying arms to the Saudis and killing us.
Yeah.
So it is very important to also understand like the different dynamics and relationships within this.
That's really interesting. Well, Mar, if I may, I'd like to move on to looking at the role. We talked about sort of the big international actors, but the work that you do is with local actors, local voices on the ground. And you can talk about that in a bit more detail, but perhaps you could perhaps say why you feel like it's important that we're engaging with those local voices as well as sort of having the big high politics in the background as well.
Yeah, can I take a step back though?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course you can.
Cool. So I think 2 points which I've already mentioned, that we need to remember why the Saudi-led coalition started.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is a problematic issue of how current Yemen conflict is defined by international media and some mm-hmm. analysts. And we see a lot of Saudi war on Yemen.
Yeah.
And we have to be clear that that is not the case, at least that is not the case from a local perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, Saudis are involved in the current conflict in Yemen, but the conflict started way before the Saudis got involved.
Sure.
And it started when... I mean, we can go as much back as much as we want, but let's take
yes.
it from
yeah, yeah, yeah.
when the Houthis took over the capital in September
mm-hmm.
of 2014.
Mm-hmm.
So if we look at that and we look when the Saudis started intervening
mm-hmm.
upon the request of the Yemen's government in March of 2015, there is a gap here of armed local and civil
mm-hmm.
Armed conflict and Houthis marching down to the capital and to other places and committing atrocities all over. So we have to remember that we have an actor that is committing as much violations
mm-hmm.
on the ground as other actors, and that it is a Yemeni conflict. So if we are to say arms trade stopped to Saudi, Saudis have withdrawn from all of its like military
mm-hmm.
Actions in Yemen. Does that end the conflict in Yemen? The answer would be, at least from my perspective, no.
Mm-hmm.
That wouldn't end it.
Yeah.
Simply because the local dynamics are still there, the root causes of the conflict is still there, and the conflict is actually initially between local actors, and it's about power sharing,
mm-hmm.
and it's about who wants what
yeah.
Out of the local context in Yemen. So I think that is just an important thing
preamble.
To know. So moving from that, I think it's really important to listen to the local voices, because they are the voices who will tell
mm-hmm.
you, actually, our main fight is not with Saudi, it's with the Houthis.
Sure.
And when you speak about the Houthis, they talk about all of the other factions, like the Islah Party, who they have declared, like 2 days ago, the Houthi, the judiciary system
mm-hmm.
have issued a death penalty against 36 activists or political prisoners. So we have to look into the
mm-hmm.
national and local politics and who is fighting
mm-hmm.
with what. Houthis have been very successful in mobilizing and utilizing the
mm-hmm.
lack of knowledge and understanding, and sometimes the cherry picking of facts, because it's easy to hate on Saudi as they commit so many violations at so many levels,
mm-hmm.
At least from the international perspective.
Yeah.
And you take that as a media propaganda from a Houthi perspective and take it to the world as we are the vulnerable
mm-hmm.
Kind of marginalized group who
mm-hmm.
have been attacked by the Saudis, and the Saudis are killing the Yemeni people, while we forget also again that the Houthis
mm-hmm.
are only using that as a propaganda machine,
as a
media campaign. On the ground, they are killing people.
Mm-hmm.
They are the group that is responsible of almost all landmines planting in Yemen, according to the UN experts report. And that has killed about, I think, according to ACLED's data, more than 5,500 people in Yemen. So,
and not only that, it's going to cause problems in the future, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is just between 2015 until June 2019. Yeah. So, if this is only landmines, we're not talking about shillings, we're not talking about tanks, we're not talking about snipers. So, just remembering that those who are saying, like, oh, we're vulnerable, we're being killed, are the ones also who are planting military positions within schools in Yemen, who are planting landmines, who are also planting sea mines, which is, again, a huge threat to international security, not only to the Yemenis. So, again, remembering all of those and remembering that the local actors will always be there. And there are local grievances that the NDC was trying to address, not in a most perfect manner. However, there was an attempt. There was an attempt to address issues and discussions, and everyone was kind of signing up to that.
And who was that? Sorry, what was that?
The National Dialogue Conference that took place in between 2013 and 2014, post the Arab Spring, as a result of the Gulf and Cooperation. The GCC
Gulf Cooperation Council.
Cooperation Council. Yes, thank you.
Teamwork.
Yes. So the initiative in Yemen, which is the transitional initiative that moved power from former President Ali Abdullah Saleh to the current government. So all of that process took place. More than 9 working groups that included about 565 Yemeni actors working on the ground together in Sana'a, trying to discuss all of the issues. And then everyone signed to the outcomes of the NDC, but the Houthis. So what they've done is they've overtaken the process. That's why a lot of analysts kind of talk about what Houthi did as a coup. Instead of just a militia who's trying to take power.
Really, really important context there.
Yes.
That people, as you were sort of talking about earlier, that people will easily forget and get caught up very much in sort of the present issues around, especially the UK focus anyway, of arms sales in Saudi Arabia, and forgetting about everything that happened.
Exactly.
Before.
So there was
integral to today, isn't it?
Yeah. So there was a power kind of sharing agreement issues that has been discussed at the NDC. There was a draft of a new constitution that was about to be announced before they kidnapped the person who was going to announce it. All of these processes happened. So Houthi's issue on power sharing and what kind of resources they get and all of that is part of a political dialogue that they decided to kind of override and overtake and move from a kind of a very soft and political transition into an armed conflict. And that is quite sad, especially if we reflect into the fact that Yemen has more than 60 million armed pieces within the civilians population. However, during the 2011 protests and uprising, none of the protesters used this. So it was a very peaceful revolution, and we tend to forget about that when we talk about the conflict now. So Yemenis did not choose conflict. Houthis imposed that conflict on everyone.
That's very, very useful. Now, if I can take us forward to sort of now, you have been working on with the Strategic Peacebuilding Program, the Oxford Research Group, for over a year now. And focusing on, as we talked about earlier, the project in Yemen. So, what are you doing in Yemen, and what is the Strategic Peacebuilding Program all about?
Well, what we're trying to do in Yemen is we work in two specific governorates. governors under the control of the internationally recognized government of Yemen, mm-hmm. in Hadramaut and Marib. These governorates are the oil-rich governorates, mm-hmm. in Yemen, but also they have some form of local authority,
sure.
and structure that still exists, so they're functioning.
Sure.
And also they have both political and tribal,
mm-hmm.
Kind of structures that are still present and, again, also
okay.
functioning,
yeah. Yeah.
Which is the main reason of why we chose to work there.
Can I just interrupt you a minute?
Yes.
Can you just, because our listeners might not necessarily understand,
yeah.
But there's only a small part of Yemen that is being directly affected by the conflict, where there is fighting ongoing. Is that correct? And,
correct.
You know, quite large areas of the country are still sort of able to function, and, as you say, sort of local governments are in place, right?
Right. Yeah. Correct. Right. So we're working in the most stable,
yeah.
within the stable,
right.
areas,
yeah.
in
good
Yemen.
Context.
Yeah. So these two governments are quite key, because also Hadramaut is almost 36% of Yemen's land.
Right. Wow. Okay.
And it also is currently the only operating land border between Yemen and Saudi Arabia.
Right.
So the Wadi'a crossing is the only crossing,
mm-hmm.
open both for commercial and civilian movement between Yemen and Saudi. And Marib is kind of the governorate where it's hosting a lot of kind of political IDPs,
mm-hmm.
from Yemen. So those,
and IDPs, for our listeners who may not know.
sorry, I'm using a lot of
That's okay.
So internally displaced persons.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And it's usually used for a lot of vulnerable people,
yeah.
but here it's sometimes also those who are politically vulnerable, who are,
uh-huh.
not able to kind of escape to other countries, but
yeah.
move within the country for their own safety. Marib is hosting a lot of those who had to flee Sana'a,
mm-hmm.
Post Houthi takeover, especially northern
mm-hmm.
political elites who haven't been able to flee outside the country. So we work with those local actors in coordination and cooperation with a local partner, the Sana'a,
mm-hmm.
Center for Strategic Studies. And with that, we used ORG's
mm-hmm.
methodology, the strategic collective strategic thinking methodology, which kind of helps group who have internal differences,
mm-hmm.
to overcome these differences and think for the kind of the common interests,
yeah.
of the collective group.
Yeah.
So Liam and I have a conflict between,
mm-hmm.
us. We both want a promotion, but we still want ORG to function, so we have our jobs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, so we have an interest in maintaining the,
mm-hmm.
the nature of the organization,
sure,
but then
sure.
the competition is about who gets,
yes.
the promotion. So similarly for the political groups, it's about Hadramaut as an identity group and as a governorate has its own demands,
mm-hmm.
its own asks from the peace process, but also beyond the peace process once we have a peace agreement, similarly for Marib. So how can,
yeah.
these actors on the ground coming from both tribal conflict and
mm-hmm.
internal tribal conflict, internal kind of competing political interests, and also the civil society actor who are not usually brought up,
yeah.
to these conversations,
yeah.
How they can think together, how they can think collectively about kind of how they can map,
mm-hmm.
Who are their allies,
yeah.
how they can work with them,
mm-hmm.
how can they think towards what they want from a peace agreement and how they can amplify the,
yeah.
voice, the local,
yeah.
voices of their groups. So what we do is we provide them a safe space, and that safe space takes place in Amman, Jordan. So you need to take the,
mm-hmm.
actors outside,
yeah.
the kind of conflict zone, but,
yeah.
also give them kind of a bit of liberty away,
sure.
from all of the kind of tribal ties,
yes.
and
the pressures
and the pressures.
Yeah, yeah.
And in that, we kind of facilitate these conversations and we help them go through the methodology,
mm-hmm.
and the questions of the methodology. and they work through it. Mm-hmm. One of the main successes for our groups is that we've managed to be one of the very few groups that had a one-to-one contact with the UN Special mm-hmm. Envoy just before the Stockholm Agreement.
Yeah.
So the local voices were actually kind of heard to a mm-hmm. certain extent, and they raised their concerns and shared how they think about the inclusion process, how they'd like to see kind of what they'd like to see from yeah. the Special Envoy and his team in the near future. At the time.
Fantastic. I mean, it's really interesting because I don't know if you wanted to cover any other ground there, but I think from the remote warfare program's perspective, something that we have been looking at is sort of British military contributions to building partner capacities, whether that was in, for example, Syria, in Iraq, or across the continent of Africa. So we're out in Mali and Kenya back in September 2018 looking at British contributions there. So in Kenya, the British effort to train Kenyans who are contributing towards the AMISOM mission in Somalia. And one of the findings from that research was that often we're focusing too much on just training troops, with this notion that by training them you're sort of able to flick a switch and defence sector reform is done, they're going to be a better military actor, more capable. But the issue is broader than that, because you might be in a country where the population does not feel like the government is the legitimate government, that the defence actor, that military of that country, isn't a particularly good actor when it comes to ensuring the defence of its own population, let alone trying to defend another country like Somalia. And that what we need, actually, is a broader sort of peace-building approach to security sector reform. Because as much as, you know, governance issues and corruption in the government is a challenge and it's a political issue, so too is, you know, corruption with a defence sector within a country as well, and that you need to make sure that the local populations are a part of that process as well. And I just wonder whether you felt like there was definitely space for perhaps, or what your views on security sector reform efforts are from countries like the UK, and whether you think there is definitely sort of a space to move towards that broad, because, you know, we talk about it a lot, you know, the stabilisation unit in the UK government, DFID. We want a whole of government approach. We need to bring all sort of levers of government together to be able to create and build stability overseas. It's part of the UK's defence engagement strategies and many others. You know, the aspirations are often correct, are very admirable and commendable, but we're not necessarily delivering on the ground, and we're throwing sort of bits of resources here and there and not really kind of delivering this vision of a whole of government approach. And what's your take on that?
Yeah, I guess there
that's
is
a lot to take there. Sorry.
Yeah,
sorry.
I guess there is also another category where you don't actually have a kind of a unified front of a defense ministry,
mm-hmm. absolutely,
which is the Yemen's problem at the moment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because yes, we have a defense minister, and we have some you know military that is still part of that, but also we have a number of new armed actors on the ground. So how do we deal with this, and what does that mean for the security sector in those kind mm-hmm. of stable spaces in Yemen? So I think there is room, but there is also room for new ones thinking how we can kind of get out of the books of this is how SSI is done,
this
is how the
security sector reform
and governance is done, so this is how we're going to do
it by
the book. By the book doesn't really work in contexts like Yemen mm-hmm. and in fragmented contexts in general. So I think, to me, one of the key things that we can do successfully is work with the local actors, understand who are the key and integral security personnel within the area, and also think about who is missing from this structure, and then try and work with the local actors on that. Mm-hmm. And I think there is as much thinking to be done with those on the ground as much as you need to think about the structures outside of the ground. So I think the consultations and the perspective of trying to understand, because here the tribal dynamics gets part of mm-hmm. the entire security sector reform process, right?
Yeah.
Because if you're excluding any actor, it is seen as if you are supporting one side, you're aligning
sure.
with one side,
yeah.
and that is not necessarily the position.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're coming from a good faith of we want a better system for
yeah.
the country,
yeah.
then you have to acknowledge what it, the kind of the do no harm approach,
mm-hmm.
basically.
Mm-hmm.
How do we do good without doing any
yeah.
harm?
Yeah.
How do we integrate with the different actors? So taking the tribal dynamics into account, taking the current security actors and the perceptions of the locals on these
mm-hmm.
functions is very critical and key. We're from the conversation we've been having with our local actors, you hear a lot of conversations that you wouldn't get out of a research piece
mm-hmm.
if you didn't have an open
yeah.
space,
yeah.
right? Like
yeah.
there is a one-to-one conversation that doesn't usually get you what you want. Or like doesn't actually help you understand what is going on the ground. So to me, the security, there is room for security sector reform. I think there is room for also security sector governance reform is quite highly unlikely at the moment.
In the Yemen context,
yes.
Yeah.
But there is room for security sector governance because there is existing structure
yeah.
that are functional. And taking these existing functional structure and
mm-hmm.
understanding how they relate to the kind of overall context of the country and the local context of each governorate in Yemen
mm-hmm.
is crucial. And creating these kind of safe and stable, or like what some call pockets of stability
mm-hmm.
In the different areas of Yemen is really important, because what we want is also to mitigate
yeah.
the deterioration of the security
mm-hmm.
situation across the country. So the room is there, but the thinking should be nuanced, and the taking the localized approach is really
mm-hmm.
as
yeah.
important
yeah.
as taking the top down
yeah.
approach.
Yeah.
So you need to marry the top down with the bottom up
yeah.
approaches
yeah.
to be able to have a functional structure, to have a civil oversight by the civil society, so
yeah.
they can kind of help understand and mitigate any IHL violation
yeah.
because that is highly likely
yeah, yeah, yeah.
in a context like Yemen, in a context of fragmentation,
mm-hmm.
but also political, what's the word? I lost it.
It's fine.
Yeah.
It might come
yeah.
to you.
Yes, it might.
It might come to you. No, but I think you're absolutely right about the focus that a country like the UK might have. And of course, some of the countries that I mentioned, for example, you know, the Amazon mission, there are so many different layers and so many different contributing countries. You've got the EU, you've got the US, you've got some GCC countries, and obviously the UK as well, all trying to sort of input, but it might not necessarily be very joined up, or might not be appropriately engaging with sort of civilian voices on the ground. And I think it's an interesting area, and something that we've been, as part of some of our research recently, about UK contributions across countries in Africa, is that you know, often when it's a low intensity or regarded as low intensity operation for the UK, very light footprint, it's not like the high intensity operations in Iraq and Syria of late, where we're countering someone like ISIS, that there won't necessarily be the emphasis on building those relationships between civilians and the military. And there's this sort of idea that, well, it's sort of small fry. We don't need to sort of put those, not institutions, but those relationships in place, where actually it could be really important and integral for the success of building stability in that particular area. If we do want to deliver on some of the things that UK says it wants to deliver on, that it needs to take that step forward and link up that political effort with the sort of the military effort, because they are so interrelated. You can't just have sort of military effect. It's not, you know, you need to have a political solution, right? You agree?
Right. I agree. I agree. And I think, yeah, the word I was looking for is polarization.
There you go. I said it would come to you.
Yeah. So I think I'm saying it because it's still relevant to what you're saying, because we have also a very polarized context and from both political actors but also tribal actors, and we have to remember the war economy and what it brings. So these are all interrelated and interlinked issues.
Absolutely.
Security is highly kind of interlinked with the economy, especially in the context of Yemen, where you have a lot of young men going into joining one of the armed actors just because that is the only source of income making at the moment. But also you have all of the black markets that has been created, and the kind of warlords around that, and how, to what extent these people also have relations to different actors, be it the political actors or the security.
Yeah.
And we have to remember that it's a lot of the internationals who visit Yemen know this. You would sit and in a negotiation table, and you'd find like the different factions fighting, and then at lunchtime you'll see them sitting together and having a laugh. Because the cultural element of things is totally different from the politics of it, and that is not necessarily common. So Yemenis have that, so we have to understand the politics and the culture behind people's motivation and stance. So I think, I don't know if I answered.
No, absolutely. Do you think, you know, there's been a lot of talk when Alistair Burt was at the Foreign Office, the minister, the Conservative minister, who recently resigned, well, back in March over Brexit. One of the things that he had sort of developing thinking around how we go into conflicts and how we sort of choose the key actors and how we try and build like a political settlement. And there was this study that came out, I think it was in June 2018, the Stabilization Unit study about, I can't remember what it's called now, but it's now sort of been integrated into the Stabilization Unit's guidance. That, you know, if you look at somewhere like Afghanistan, US, I suppose the UK as well, sort of are trying to, with the Afghan government, have some sort of political settlement with the Taliban, which was probably, you know, completely unpalatable back in 2001, this idea that you would ever negotiate with the Taliban, but was probably fairly predictable that you'd have to get into that position because it is tribal, it's very complex. You sort of need to establish, as you were describing, those pockets of stability to be able to retain even some sort of loose Afghan state. I mean, you know, at the moment it's looking like they're going to have some sort of agreement with the Taliban. And I wonder whether there's like a movement in thinking about how we approach different conflicts and how we identify particular adversaries, because actually perhaps we are putting ourselves in a straitjacket if we label someone as someone that we're never going to, or a group as a group that we're never going to be able to negotiate with. And do you feel like there's kind of an acceptance that we need to develop that thinking about peace building, I suppose?
Oh, well, in Yemen's case, there isn't necessarily a faction that anyone is refusing to have as part of the negotiation. However, there is the issue of exclusion when it comes to the actual peace process and who is part of that peace process. Because all of the new factions and, for example, the Southern Movement and their position, the separatists in Yemen, and their position pre-2015 and their position currently is quite different, and their power is different. And it was a kind of a civil, peaceful movement. Mm-hmm. Now a lot of the movement has arms as a result of the current conflict. So they are becoming kind of strongly involved within the kind of security and armed conflict. So how do we take those as an actor, and how do we deal with them is an important question as the demands of the people is a rightful demand, and whether we agree or disagree with that, it is a different discussion. But whether they should be part of the table, that shouldn't be a question, right? But that is still kind of the dilemma for a lot of international actors and the UN Special Envoy and the mandate of how Yemen is being dealt with at the moment. So we don't have, in Yemen, there is no actor that has been kind of identified as a...
Yes.
Because they are not a terrorist. None of those are described as a terrorist group, which I think is the main, like the baseline for why and international governments won't agree to have a conversation with. So it's quite different, but I think, yes, there needs to be kind of an open ear to listen to all of those local actors and see how we can have even a parallel process that takes the grievances of those actors and their security concerns that comes with it. Because it's all about not only power sharing, but the kind of feel, the threats, the security threats, which is part of the Saudi argument around we need to protect our borders, which is a valid argument.
And have been, you know, they've been attacked, haven't they, by the Houthis on their home turf.
And Saudis will always be the neighbours of Yemen. Yeah. That's not going to change. So how do we take that into consideration and how do we take a position that is helpful to all actors? But also, Yemen is sitting in a very strategic location. That doesn't only affect Yemenis and Saudis, it also affects the international trade, the international naval trade, and oil pipelines, so many other things, and the links with the Horn of Africa and how close we are to Somalia, Djibouti and Ethiopia and all of that. So there are higher security concerns and worrisomes to both local actors and international actors when it comes to Yemen that we need to think of beyond Saudis bombarding the local.
Yeah, and considerations that, you know, from the UK context that are above just arms sales, because you could say, well, actually, the contribution of arms sales to the HMT, Her Majesty's Treasury, is quite small, really. But, you know, the UK government would argue, well, it's about, you know, strategic interests in the Gulf and everywhere else. So, yeah, I think it's really important to raise that point. But Mara, I was going to end there, but you want to say last word?
It's I guess from kind of for the arms trade campaigners, they have to remember that this all is happening with the, you know, targeting support in the operation rooms from the UK government and from the US government. And let's imagine if that didn't exist. So I think it's important to hold this.
Although it's not quite clear exactly what the UK is providing in terms of support.
Allegedly.
They've never made it clear.
Yeah, so allegedly, if that exists and the situation and the death toll is the way we see it, how about if that is not even there? Yeah.
So I mean, I remember the Committee on Arms Exports Control when they published, I think it was back in, was it 2017? Where basically there was this line where it said, pretty much, to paraphrase entirely, but we have absolutely no idea exactly what the UK is doing. On the one hand, they've said this. On the other hand, they've said that. We don't know what they're doing in the targeting rooms. And Alistair Burt, when he was minister, I know it came up against a question from... God, I've forgotten his name. Andrew Mitchell, the former International Development Secretary and a key supporter in Parliament around the issues on Yemen, basically asking, are we a party to this conflict? Are we providing support in the targeted rooms? And Alistair Burt sort of seemed to say quite unequivocally, we are not providing that support. I mean, I don't know.
We will never know. It's the rumours, really.
we don't know, but no.
This is not to say it's okay. It's just to say that... There are things that are also as important beyond the arms that got sold.
I mean, I think we at least know that there was some sort of advice around IHL, but exactly how that was being applied was slightly confusing. Yeah. But no, you're absolutely right. Anyway, on that note, Marwa, thank you so much. We've covered a lot of ground there. UK sort of context of the conflict in Yemen and the focus perhaps too much on sort of the role of Saudi Arabia. Then going down to sort of the linkages between how we sort of argue that it's much broader than just arms sales, it's like the security relationship itself. Then looking at sort of what the strategic peace building program's doing, the local voices, why local voices are really important, and specifically how you're going about implementing this theory on communities in Yemen, which is really, really interesting.
With and then communities in Yemen.
With communities in Yemen. Did I not say that? Sorry.
You say on.
Oh, with communities. With communities in Yemen. See, look, language is very important. And then we ended with sort of, again, some linkages between what the remote warfare program is doing and arguing for a much more sort of peace-building approach towards security sector reform. And how that might link in with some of what the strategic peace-building program is sort of advocating for in terms of creating those pockets of stability, making greater linkages between military civilian actors, really important to achieve what we set out to achieve, or at least what we're aspiring to achieve in many of these places. Well, Mara, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Liam.
And thanks also to all our listeners for tuning in. We hope you enjoy the discussion as much as I did. And for those who want to read in more depth about the topics we covered, we put links to any research or publications that we have mentioned in the episode notes. Go and have a look at those right away. And if you want to stay up to date with the Remote Warfare Programme and Oxford Research Group's work, please subscribe to our newsletter by clicking on the button at the top of the page. Now, if you are Twitter savvy, you can follow us on Twitter, and our handles are at ORGinfo and at remote_warfare. You can listen to all our previous episodes for free, what a fantastic deal, by following the link at the top of the page. We look forward to you joining us soon. Goodbye.